Responsibility will come to order. First thing we will consider is amendment to House Bill 2157. The Attorney General, Mr. Johnson, will walk through them with us.
Mr. Chairman,
we'll refresh you with amendments, but
I think we have it, Lee.
We got it.
Well, you have those?
Yeah. No, it's just a second, but you might need to
You never know, he may have changed.
Okay, all right.
Try to get him to put a date on these things, nobody will do it.
You'll recall at the last hearing, we brought to you a series of amendments. We thought you may want to consider each one of them separately. As I read the consensus to the committee at that time, there was no objection to those amendments, and we combined them all into this one amendment that you have before you. And in addition, since that meeting, some of you may have received a statement from the ACLU, particularly Professor Beatry, making some suggestions, many of which we thought were really excellent. We subsequently conferred with him by phone, made some redrafts, and reached a basic agreement with him over the amendments. And basically what all these relate to is Section 11 of the bill, which is that section that enumerates the exceptions to the basic principle that all public records are public. If you will go back in this, as you'll see, these amendments are not quite as extensive as you might think, but we have attached some supplementary material, but if you'll go back in the back of it, we have just rewritten Section 11 as it would be written if these amendments were adopted. And I'd be glad to go through that with
you. Yeah, I wish you would, Lee. Where do you want us to start in
here? If you go back to, I think, really the easiest way, because all of these just simply rewrite Section 11, and the rest of it is conforming, isn't it, right, Dan?
Mostly.
Yeah. This portion in the back end of that set of material I just gave you, this is Section 11 as amended. First off, we got into the problem that certain types of things, you know, you can have a different burden of proof than others, and so we separated from that standpoint. Okay, subsection 1, the following public records are exempt from disclosure under this Act unless public interest requires disclosure in a particular instance. And then first is those records pertaining to litigation. And the language we've used there is, the only changes are primarily to tighten that language down from the original bill. Secondly, is trade secrets. We have not changed that information.
I'm not the same place you are.
I'm sorry.
Some proposed amendments to House Bill 2157.
Yeah, those are amendments. But if you go back in the back, there is a rewrite. At the top, it says Section 11 as amended. What it is Section 11, if you adopt these amendments. What we try to do is engross it for you, so it makes it a little bit easier to read it. The trade secrets, we have not changed. The investigatory information compiled for criminal law purposes has been changed to clarify what type of information is confidential and what is not. I don't think they know. It's just merely with some change in wording to tighten things down. Test scores.
Wait a minute. Clear need. Who makes that determination, Mike? This is very important. Anybody want to talk with me? It's the last line.
Oh, okay. Well, arrest records would be public records. Unless and only so long as there is a clear need in a particular disclosure in the course of an investigation. This would be jeopardize maybe some other arrests that were in the process, that type of thing. By the way, I think you're touching on something, Mr. Chairman, which I don't think we ought to try to get into this bill. It really is a whole question which my office is presently working on. We're going to try to get together with the DAs and the law enforcement agencies and the press association, see if we can't get some kind of agreement on standards of what information is released and what isn't in criminal law matters. But I still think this bill only deals with those records.
Move the table, and here you come up with.
That's a matter of a question of standards. Test questions, the only thing is here is we change the language to qualify it as to before the exam is given or if the examination is not to be used again. In other words, just to put some lid on that. Production records, business records, these are to take care of course, of your primarily your statutory themes that are based upon volumes of business, and to lump them all into one provision. This was in the original bill, and I don't think there's anything to change it. Other than clarifying language. F was the same as the original bill. G was the same.
In the open hearing bill, did we leave in the reference to real estate negotiations as being an executive session?
I'm sure it could be if they desired.
Took it out except that I forgot the building.
Yeah, I can negotiate purchases.
Yeah.
Okay. It's kind of inconsistent if we had it here.
Yeah. Here again, we're talking about records versus meetings. I frankly don't see that the records. I think there's more reasons to open the records except those appraisals. The appraisals I do not think that would put us in a very definite litigation wise. We believe in reciprocity on appraisal.
Why don't we write that in?
Well, of course they are. This has been pretty much our policy on many. G is a new one. It was suggested by the Public Employees Relations Board. It is one that is not now in the law, but it is common throughout all labor law. This is where you have a decertification or a certification election. Those authorization cards are common. And I think there's good reason to be. And this has strong precedent in the NLRB and in most of the area of labor relations. People couldn't be able to just fish through them to find out who's great. Okay, then sub 2. We've divided this because all of these are basically measured by a public interest test alone. Sub 2 sets up some other exemptions, but there is a separate burden of proof test for each one. First is the communications of the public body within a public body. These are the communications between employees primarily. And it only applies when this exemption shall not apply unless the public body shows that in the particular instance, public interest in encouraging frank communication between officials and employees of public bodies clearly outweighs the public interest in disclosure. In other words, it's a much heavier burden of proof on the state to try to withhold that type of information. What it's designed to protect is the offhand comments that public employees who would have to be revealed, automatically have to be revealed. Likewise, if it was a combination of both, then under a separate section in the state's obligation to segregate. Sub B is the personal privacy exemption, and here we've shifted the public interest the burden of proof the other way, and said unless the public interest by clear and convincing evidence requires the disclosure in a particular instance. Here we're trying to put the burden on the person who's trying to get the material. Pretty obvious why that kind of burden should be. Sub C was clarifying language. This is material that comes to a government body, information that comes to a government body in which there is no obligation to provide that information to the government body. It is provided in confidence. And the individual find the information has to be kept in confidence.
Safeway stores beer sales for the estimation of a tax on beer or something like that.
Well, it's more likely the hot tip. The report to the Secretary of State's office that candidate X is not reporting all his expenditures. I guess he may be looking at corporate records for somebody, that type of thing. Please don't reveal my name. Well, again, there is a public interest. There is a. It can be revealed if the court feels a compelling the public interest.
Have you
done
these?
Yes, I do. The correction provision, that's the same as it was in the previous bill. The banking commissioner was one of the amendments we'd already submitted. The rest of these are amendments that we have already submitted, right? Yeah. And is that list attached on the
part of the report?
All right. If you look at subsection H, look in the middle of this material you have, it gives you what those statutes are. In other words, it merely reincorporates all those present statutes that we feel are still justified as far as confidentiality.
In that regard, the hospital people claim that 41.675 was inadvertently omitted.
We missed it, basically. question of tax records. The present statute dealing with tax records is a prohibition against employees of the Department of Revenue. This would apply to other public employees who, for some reason or another, got a hold of those tax records. Subsection 3 is made it clear about segregation, and that the material, the documents contain exempt material and non-exempt material, meaning it's due upon the state to segregate that material. And then subsection 4, which was in the original bill, would take care of the problems that we just made. And I'm, as an example, tonight we missed one statute. We have gone through these statutes and gone through them. We have sent inquiries to every agency, as has your committees. But there is a possibility that we've missed something. This section provides that the governor may, after a hearing, provide for an exemption upon making certain findings. And we used this same provision under the Administrative Procedures Act last biennium, and we picked up one that we used on, and frankly forgot the correction to this. It has some kind of serious problems, as you can imagine.
Did you reference the subsection 1, or I should have the subsection 1 and 2?
We tried to outline what we thought were the policy decisions. kind of using this public interest test in all instances where a record is disclosed. Now, I noticed this with respect to, let me turn to page 4 here, where there's a subdivision 8. this is all begun or accompanied by a disclaimer in section 11 sub 1.
No, we broke it out.
Yeah, we broke it out.
That was as a result of Dixie's criticism, which we thought were very valid.
Yeah, well, any objection I would have has already been outdistanced by that change, and I think that's a wholly satisfactory resolution. The point was that the public interest test could be used to qualify a privilege, which otherwise in state law is made absolute, and I think that's well taken care of. I'm sorry to take 5 minutes of your time.
No problem. Let's let the council have any comments on anybody in the audience have any comments on section 11? Are you satisfied, Tom?
I haven't seen what it is.
Show Tom that one section.
I've heard no mention of personnel matters.
It does not. I think it does not take care of Mr. Enright's objection, because his view is that we ought to include, you know what that statute is, John? The one that
351065.
What is that?
351065.
Well, it's a statute that deals. Oh, pardon me, John. Tom, I'm confused now.
Which resulted in a bill which the chairman sponsored in involving the personal records of people in higher education. Now, under the authority given to them in 351.065, the State System of Higher Education adopted rules regarding personnel records. And those rules don't even give the academic employee, the professor, the right to the personnel record that concerns him, much less somebody else's. Now, we'd like two things. One is that he get access to his own record, and secondly, that he get access to the records of people similarly situated, if he's in a tenure case or something of that sort, where you're trying to make comparisons that would show how he's been treated. Mr. Johnson sent a letter to me regarding primarily classified personnel. At one time said, if the question comes to me, there isn't any question that I will decide that a person has access to his own personal record. But I don't know that he was talking about higher education and their rulemaking authority under 351.065 or whatever it is, whether he would feel that he could make a finding under HB 2157 if it passes that higher ed had to make available to a professor his own record. Now, this type of thing came up on the before the House Judiciary Committee on 2496, and at that time we suggested that maybe that bill might be forwarded over to this committee to be considered as part of the whole matter of public records. And I don't know whether it ever was officially forwarded to you or whether just individuals on the committee were going to call it to the attention of this committee.
We haven't seen it.
Representative Paulus is the name of the talking to about. He was the one who kind of suggested to Dave Philmeyer and I after the hearing on 2496 that maybe professional responsibility might consider the content of 2496 of that particular bill, 2496, as part of the 2157. Of course, this is a very controversial thing, and in all respects, Dave can give you, and I have an essay, I called it, pages and pages and pages long, why faculty members shouldn't see the evaluations that their peers and others make about them. And of course, we feel that they should, and many of our professors feel that it's even unfair to them as evaluators to say that I am so chicken that I won't make an evaluation of my colleague unless it's kept private. But it's a very controversial subject, and one which, as I say, was considered over in House Judiciary, and then our feeling is maybe it belongs someplace in this bill.
Are you there on that one, George?
Yeah, we need to work. We haven't done anything about it.
Well, that's fine. You'd like to keep it.
Let me say, Mr. Chairman,
we haven't had a hearing
at the outset. I'm not that familiar with 2496, but it would be my, as I had advised Mr. Enright at the time, he was talking about personnel division records, but it is our general view. We have had cases, particularly in welfare, where recipients were asking for their files, the welfare division.
My view is, in response, that the personal privacy exemption, which is on page 3 covers all these issues. Now we're going to have some interpretive problems. But I have assured Mr. Enright, and I would advise the agency that my general view would be is that the person who is the subject of the file, that there is no personal privacy involved there at all, and therefore it is record that he has access.
You've already ruled that way, haven't you, in the pop-up case?
Actually, the issue in that case was the question of information that had been supplied, and it could be argued that the information was supplied and it was not required. It was supplied in confidence. It was reports of people who had said, we will make this report on the basis that it's confidential. There was no legal requirement that they provide that report.
What was the first thing you mentioned, Tom? Was that all on the bill?
The first thing was on general personal records of a salary classification and so forth nature.
You have no sweat with that, basically.
And
well, he was bothered. There is a statute in the personnel division statute that says they're public records. My response to that is that this bill says they're public records. No question about any public records unless they can come within the personal privacy exemption. And as to a person who is subject to that file, I can't think of any situations where I would think there was anything but, that was not personal privacy. Because, as to him, as to somebody else, it would be.
I think the best we can hope is that if this bill passes and during the next 2 years, some of these things will come to the attention of the Attorney General. And if the rule is addressed satisfactorily, maybe we'll be back here with a bill next time.
Or first year.
Chairman. Lee, on 4B, page 5, the governor's exempting certain classes. Sub B requires the holding of public hearing pursuant to 183 before he can grant the exception or exemption. There situations where it may be an emergency situation or there should be some hold on the disclosure until the determination is made. Wouldn't this procedure perhaps drag out to some period of time during which time the disclosures would continue to be made until the exemption is confirmed?
Well, George, I understand what the problem is. I think basically, though, what would happen is that, you know, it was a serious situation. The governor would simply tell them to hold and order an immediate hearing.
Well, the complaint would get an injunction, couldn't it?
Yeah, and the court would probably postpone it until the governor made the decision. I recognize the problem, but I think it was addressed.
You don't see any need for him to have some emergency authority spelled out.
I'd rather not do it, because the purpose of this section was to make sure when he does grant an exemption, it's done right out in the open. And I think as a practical matter, if that type of a situation did occur, he can get it done. We can hold a hearing off and quit. I have found that I can move very quickly if he asks me to hold a hearing.
All right, now, do you have any comments on the first part of this bill?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think Dave...
We have some amendments here, and are those...
Which ones? I don't know which. Chairman?
Yes?
Are you getting ready to adopt an amendment proposed by Mr. Johnson?
Yeah.
Can I ask one question about the release rate?
Please do.
It's not a very big one, but maybe I should talk here. And I was kind of trying to see see whether it maybe had been resolved, and it may have been. I'm sorry for not being a little better prepared than where we are. I'm our legal department.
We introduced yourself, Ward.
Ward Armstrong with Warehouse Company, for the record. Was a little concerned with the language in Section 11 of the original bill, subsection D, that reads information is submitted to a governmental body in confidence and not otherwise required by law to be submitted. Unless the public interest in disclosure clearly outweighs the public and private interest in non-disclosure. Now, our concern here is that frequently we'll submit information voluntarily. A good example would be to the Department of Revenue on something that, where it helps them to do a better job of assessment of property if they have companies' private records, and we do this voluntarily, and many companies do. But we are alarmed that there's a possibility of that information being made public. And it has not been. It's not been a problem. Now, the concern of Tacoma was the qualifying language beginning on line 30, unless the public interest in disclosure clearly outweighs the public and private interest in non-disclosure. Now, I see in the amendment, it really appears to be an improvement has been made in on page 3, sub C.
Yeah.
Except that it's kind of spoiled by the last clause again, and when the public interest would suffer by the disclosure. I wonder if that couldn't read, the public interest would not suffer by the non-disclosure.
Don't walk in with double negatives like that, Warren.
Well, I didn't start the sentence. Mr. Chairman, I raise that as something that is, it's contact our legal department. I'd raise it to your attention and see if, you know,
as a practical matter, Warren, if attorney at the administrative level,
anybody else in the audience on Section 11?
I'd like to have a motion to adopt.
So moved.
The move that section 11 as amended be adopted. Any discussion? Clerk, call the roll.
Representative Winters?
Aye.
Representative
Daly? Aye.
Reprogramming or something of that nature, he can have it, but he'll have to pay the expense of it.
the bill you're talking about? 2964?
I don't remember what the number is, but...
No, that's land use. Never know. Here's the calendar, anyway. Do you know what number of the Tom's on?
I thought he said 2496.
Maybe that.
But at least that's the number I wrote down.
Shall give him on demand a certified copy of it, if the record is of a nature permitting such copy, or shall furnish a reasonable opportunity to inspect the copy or copies. You don't need to put anything about anybody's expense or anything like that in there?
Let's
okay, it's next to
somewhere else.
Subsection 2 there.
We did click on that reference.
Okay. Do you want to move to take that out, tag that computer data?
Chairman, I have, if you will note, the set of amendments that I gave you that primarily deals, bring section 11 in the form that you adopted.
Yeah, got it, okay.
The first part of those amendments contain these changes we're trying to
do. Okay. Let's go through the rest of them then.
All right. The next one is on... All right. This was merely just a change of language, from a change from privilege of noun disclosure to right to withhold disclosure. Okay, page 6.
Mr. Johnson, before we go any further, I have a note written on page 3. It says, "How about a legislative council?" On subsection 3 of section 6.
We left that in.
Well, you decided that was okay. That was a question we had before.
Page 3,
section 6, sub 3. The Attorney General shall serve as counsel for the state agency in a suit filed under subsection 2. With a question, the legislative council should be included in this.
Legislative council is a state agency.
Okay. Good enough.
Yeah.
Okay.
George, you had a question.
Didn't have much clout ever.
I guess we
get to it. We did some of the bill one time. That time they refused to pay. We're keeping track of our settlement.
Okay, Lane.
Page 6, line 10.
I guess we'll take these all at once instead of...
How about, are we going to go through the amendments first, and then should we catch them as we go?
Let's catch them as we go.
Okay.
Now, section 7, the bill makes reference to the district attorney representing. Did we raise a question about the city attorney last hearing in regards to city matters?
This is one other policy that's in this whole area, the administrative review. Bill is drafted. As for state agencies, the administrative review would be through the Attorney General's office. As for the local bodies, would be through the Office of District Attorney.
How about those counties that have county councils?
Well, the point is, was to place the function, our view was to place it in an elected official, because he's subject to the heat.
Yeah.
case it's the district attorney independently and not as counsel, then makes the determination, and there is then an appeal to the court. If the agency is upheld, it will use whatever counsel it ordinarily uses, and that might be the district attorney if it's the county. If it's the city, it will use the city attorney as it would in any case. The only the specific reason for putting this language in is that so far as state agencies are concerned, there's a provision that the attorney general shall not serve as counsel for the state agency if he's decided against the state agency, so he doesn't have any conflict of interest. This simply says that the DA is in the same position as the attorney general, and he accepts, of course, that he doesn't serve as counsel for a city or some other body that he never was and never will be counsel for.
Okay, now in section 8, my note says it was proposed by the attorney general, but he really doesn't like it.
Now, Mr. Chairman, this section here, I don't know, this provision here, I'm not going to feel badly about what you do with it. It did provide that where it is an elected official whose records are in question, for example, the governor's records, then there would not be any administrative review to go directly into court. And the reason for that was just to avoid the conflict between elected officials. You ram it down my throat, I guess I'm going to shut it. I don't want it.
Line 26, is that?
Right. There is present provision of law.
What's the consensus on the committee? Nicer than some other people I know, Mama.
Occasionally.
Do you feel it should or should not be in there? Is what I'm trying to get at. George?
You run into the situation here that you just get two elected officials.
What does it add to the bill?
Well, what it adds to the bill, or what it takes from the bill, is that if you're trying to get an elected official's record, first off, okay, this guy is an elected official, the governor. Mm. Somebody's trying to get records out of the governor's office. He says, well, they're not subject to disclosure. He's got another pressure on him that the bureaucrat over here doesn't have. He's got gentleman over here on my left screaming and yelling at him and putting the heat to him. And that, I think, is one reason why you can exempt elected officials. But this is only an administrative review. They still be subject to a court order. Secondly, I think it avoids an unnecessary conflict between elected officials and state governors, between myself, the governor, the secretary of state, state treasurer. I mean, if the secretary is, well, let me put it this way, let's put it in the real world. If the state treasurer wants to withhold something that he hasn't got any justification to withhold, he really don't need an administrative review. He's either out of his tree, or he's going to reveal those documents.
And the court can make him.
And the court can make him.
leave it in.
I think I would prefer to leave it in also.
The Attorney General originally wrote the bill. I think we should leave it in. No?
I'd like to take it out.
He's speaking as a attorney type or a...
Why, Joey?
Well, I don't want the test to be any good.
You don't know what?
Why the test should be any good. Or your remedy should be any good.
I wonder if that's saying something.
Okay, let's go on then.
Maybe they don't think
we don't know. Now, the rest of these are strictly housekeeping down to... unless anybody else has some notes on there.
Just double check.
Did any of you, George, do you have any, Ed, do you have any notes in any place?
No, not for the
double.
We're taking care of section 11.
Yeah, section 11 is doing it.
That's where I had a lot of notes.
We had section 12.
Oh, yeah.
I had to delete section 12.
Yeah, I took all the 12 out.
What happens when we get to section 13?
Put those back in.
Page 7, line 26.
Oh, he's got it, yeah, that we did delete it. Right. Let's leave it by amendment. On page 5, it is amendment. Top of page.
I have a question regarding section 9.
Okay, Jack.
What section?
Section 9, sub 1, will you give the court jurisdiction to join the public body in any suit filed under section 6 to 8? So 8 speaks to the elected official rather than a public body. Shouldn't it be the court has jurisdiction to enjoin the public body or elected official? Line 31?
No, because public section 2 defines public body and includes state officer, agency, departmental, division, bureau, ordinarily state officer.
On the definition, okay.
If you open these 2 side doors,
you
get something
to
talk about.
We're outside. Okay, I have an issue with this one.
Is there
not a coat?
Oh, that's going up again. Okay. Yeah, that feels good. Okay, then we go to, we took out section 12, Lee.
Actually, section 12 came out, right.
Right.
No, it didn't.
Section 10 is out, too?
No, 10 is out.
Page 13 is only to bring it into line.
page 11, where you're reinstating the top page 11, line 1, where you're reinstating that subsection or part of it. The public officer shall not be examined as to public records exempt from disclosure, so forth.
Oh, pardon me. Yeah, I'm sorry, we did. We put in, yeah.
What's the, does this conflict a little bit with the exceptions, or a part of the exemption, such as
no.
The public interest?
No, what this is trying to clarify, George, is first, we have had a definite question, and the court itself didn't pop it out, but he was trying to think from it. As to why this section should have anything to do with public records. This is a privilege.
Do you have any testimonial cards on this?
Okay, in our view, we ought to get rid of the executive privilege. And then on reconsideration, we had to say, well, do I have the executive privilege to the same extent that you have it for public records? In other words.
Oh, Dave's right back there now.
Oh, Wayne.
A weighing test on that. As the communication is not factual nature.
You better be happy because I'm going to ask you to carry the bill.
Mr. Chairman, I will do one other thing.
I still don't get the explanation.
Well, okay. Instead of reading the way it does now, it would read, a public officer shall not be examined as the public records exempt from disclosure under the 1973 Act. Public records exempt are in Section 11, and it is adopted.
Yes, it's our exception.
It's a very qualified privilege. Very limited privilege. It's, where the devil is it? Communications within a public body or between public bodies of an advisory nature, to the extent that they cover other than purely factual materials and are preliminary to any final agency determination, policy, or action. Any exemption shall not apply unless the public body shows that in a particular instance, the public interest in encouraging frank communication between officials and employees, the public body clearly outweighs the public interest in disclosure.
All right, now in all instances of the
frankly, this is almost a non-existent privilege testimonial because you could show it's relevant. I think the court would probably, on this day, will better come in.
In all those exemptions, is the burden on the public body?
No. In this one, it is. Personal privacy is just the reverse. It's on the citizen trying to.
That's the only exception. Burden on, in all their instances on the public body?
Basically, yes, right?
There's a catch-all provision indicating the burden is on the public body in other cases, but there are some of these cases, and there wouldn't be any circumstances where the private party, in order to establish the public interest, would have to be able to examine a public office. The burden is on the private party to establish the public interest. And the only way you could establish that is to have to examine the public body, and you couldn't examine the public body by reason of this.
Yeah, but here, okay, suppose you put my deputy on the stand, and he says, well, I refuse to testify on the basis of his privilege. The burden would be on him, presumably we'd have to come in and intervene and make a compelling case to the court of why his testimony should not be compelled. I can't imagine, frankly, I think the bar is pretty much non-existent for privileges and the way we've written the bill. And that's my view of what happened.
So you don't see any conflict then?
No.
Thank you.
in the bill that's in the entry again?
That's out. Yeah.
That's been omitted.
Page what, please?
Page 15 to 17.
All those pages are deleted.
15 to 17 are out. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Lines 1 through 19 are 8.
Mr. Chairman, was it the committee's feeling that he didn't want to incorporate any part of that bill that seemed to be sharing with them?
I thought, Norma, that rather than jeopardize the fate of this bill, it would be better to have that come out separately.
Seems like this would be the logical place to make this.
We're not sure it is.
What is it, Norma? Well, we have a bill in judiciary which would allow a faculty member, an institution, a higher education, State of Oregon, to see his or her record, which he cannot do now.
And everybody else?
No. The bill says that, but I don't agree that that would be properly included, but...
We seem to feel that this took care of that problem as to their own record.
I don't think this...
Regulations adopted under subsection 1 of this section shall require the personnel records be subject to restrictions on access, unless upon a finding by the institutional executive of public interest in maintaining individual rights of privacy in an adequate educational environment would not suffer by disclosure of such personal records. Access to personal records may be only designated classes of information or persons or just stated times and conditions or disposal. It cannot be limited to records of academic achievement or all right. We have not repealed this statute. It was my understanding from Tom Enright that faculty members can't get access to their own records. As I read this statute, when you agree, and the board has no basis because there's no individual privacy involved there. You know, as the faculty member investigating his own file.
At least the first portion of that proposed amendment would restate
what the law is.
Plain and simple language, what it should probably be construed to mean anyway.
Well, why don't we might solve the problem by requesting an opinion from the Attorney General and sending that then to the presidents of those colleges that have been in to pass the Trump, pass the bill.
And I agree with you. I do not think I can understand argument, but I don't think we should have access to other backgrounds.
I don't think any reason for him to have access to other backgrounds.
Well, I don't think anyone really on our committee thought that either, but they certainly did think they had the right to use their own records.
Well,
what information?
And what are you going to prove? Are you trying to prove they're using a different method of evaluation?
The objection they had to the, if I remember now, the objection they had to allowing the individual to see his own file, they would have information in there signed by students who have been asked to evaluate, you know, the individual, and they're afraid there would be some reaction against those students because of that.
Well,
they wanted to reserve that right, they wouldn't have to disclose that information.
Well, I don't know what that statute talks about.
No, but that was their reasoning as to why they would deny
but not
that action. As I remember, that was a substantial basis for their argument.
Well,
our student evaluation signed by the students.
Apparently.
I think they're in my chairman, my name is Forte Schiff from Florida State University. Legislation gives the board authorization to make rules pertaining to access of faculty members to his or her individual file. State Board of Higher Education has adopted regulations, and they're more or less guidelines, and each institution now is in the process of promulgating their own rules. The faculty member does have access to his or her own file. There's two alternatives. One is completely open, so the faculty member can see everything in his or her file. And the other alternative is they can see everything but confidential evaluations, and in that case, all information has to be disclosed without revealing the source. So I don't think it's correct in saying that the faculty member does not have access to their file right now. But it's by academic rule, not by law?
I believe 351 lays out the ground without ORS. I can't cite you the
ground. Well, it's right there, Frosty.
Well, let me say what I think is at stake here. First, as I read that statute, it's the same standard that is in 2157, the question of personal privacy. But then you may have material in the file which is submitted by a volunteer in confidence, and that really comes under a different standard. There may be grounds for withholding that material. But if, for example, the required merit rating report, I don't think they have any basis to withhold.
Well, Foster brings up something else about the confidentiality of those personal evaluation reports. We haven't said anything about that. Do we have to worry about that if the college files are open? In other words, could the personnel officer go through and pick out the evaluation and say, here's the rest of your record?
He could pick out, you can pull out. Well, okay. The standard in that, if it was under 2157, you could pull out the comments that were made by a volunteer that were submitted in comments.
What about his peers?
If they're not required to provide that information, it was submitted to confidence,
all the states that the state board may promulgate regulations authorizing issuance of rules, and access to personal records may be limited to designated classes of information or persons, or to stated times and conditions, but cannot limit records of academic achievement.
Yeah, but it puts a, there is a clause in there dealing with personal privacy.
Right.
Which, in other words, he could not, the state board could not say you cannot have access to your personal file, period.
Well, you know, we're debating.
The statute would not permit it.
We're debating a question that's in another bill, and I really think maybe we ought to stick to one we have. And let you worry about that other one, George, because it's in your committee.
Well, I just hate seeing anything taken out of the personnel file, because when that person looks at his personnel file and his promotion or assignment or salary increase is going to be based on it, and he's looking at his personnel file and it's incomplete, he's being denied a promotion from that. He has no grounds, you know, really to look at it in a complete
manner. It's a qualified withholding. For example, in Papadopoulos, they tried to withhold this report. Now here, you could claim the exemption that was submitted in confidence. I have no question I would have to change what I said earlier, because that's what I told the state board at the time. And no question that the court was going to order to disclose it, even though it had been submitted in confidence, because here, the guy's job was at stake, and they were basing it on that report and refusing him to reveal the report. But you have to have a balancing test here. That's what you get.
Somebody knew that what they're disclosing may be revealed to the individual they're disclosing it about, that might keep them a little more honest in what they're saying.
On the other hand, you might not get as much honesty, too.
I don't know.
Amendment.
No, we were going to wait. I move that we adopt the amendment.
It's been move that we adopt amendment.
Whatever they are.
Have we gotten through all of them?
Yeah.
Most of that language has been enjoyed all the way through section
5. Oh.
Find something last section.
How about the change?
Oh, we
have
changes in amendment.
Section 33A? What's that?
Well, this is a summary.
Any reason.
I got a message.
Well, you said something about 8:30. I do believe.
Oh, I was kidding, really.
Oh, shucks. You make bad jokes.
There was no definition of lobbying in that bill, but
in our existing statute, 157.755, there is a definition of lobbying, and that's contained in that first sheet you have, which we think is pretty good. It seems to take care of the usual and the usually thought of definition, and we think that it is concise enough to take in most of what most of us think of as lobbying. In our consideration of this theory, we thought this, that there's no reasonable workable way to include the person off the street, housewife, rich changers, if you will, individuals who are there by themselves with some kind of a cause, because there's no agency, no person can reasonably work this into a registration situation. However, it is apparent that there are many, many organizations who come here as an organization, represented or not represented by an individual. And if the basic premise is, the approach to this is to find out who is lobbying, who is representing what cause, and have a workable registration system so that everybody knows who's who, we felt that maybe these organizations ought to be brought in. Now, this first page that contains the definition that we have in our existing law, we did, in projecting this basic premise, we have asked Chuck Wilson of Legislative Council to try to put this in proper phrasing and so forth, so that it expresses this theory. If you look on the page that does have a our existing law, we've changed paragraph 2, sub A. Any person who agrees to provide his personal services for money or any other consideration for the purpose of lobbying. That seems to go back to the, as long as you have a definition of lobbying, we thought it best to use that.
Dave, excuse me, did you pick out what lobbying means? As I recall, in your bill, there's no definition of lobbying.
No, the reason that wasn't done, I don't want to interrupt the testimony, but the reason that it wasn't done is that lobbying, the registration and reporting are defined in terms of what a lobbyist does in House Bill 2530, and therefore a separate definition of lobbying itself is unnecessary, to the extent that what you're merely doing is describing what the lobbyist does, and then having reporting and registration requirements cast in terms of whether or not the person fits at A through B. I recall last week Senator Ripper asked me to try to come up with a definition of lobbying, and at the risk of submitting another long essay, I've put together a memorandum form for members of the committee. Various different definitions. This is basically a collation of existing state legislation in five or six other states which do attempt to define lobbying. And in addition, it's a larger attempt to put it in perspective by showing various approaches. There's five different approaches that a state might use in defining what lobbying is. And then finally, to show some of the constitutional problems of drafting a definition which goes too broadly and therefore interferes with the citizen's right of petition.
The present law that Dick's talking about, do you have a problem with that?
Not really. No, I think it's a good starting point. I have some technical objections to it that I think would help to make it to cover more things.
Do you have a copy of his
definition? Yes, I do.
Okay.
With respect to the definition of lobbying here, it talks about the attempting to influence the passage or defeat of a measure. That makes it sound like it's specifically related to the text of a law, but under these terms, the person who lobbied against the Senate approval of a nomination of the person to be an executive officer or whatever in the state would not be covered by lobbying. So I would prefer to see, if this is to be used, I would prefer to see the term legislation used and then defined as broadly as it's done in California and under the Federal Act. And legislation would basically mean anything that could legitimately come before the Legislative Assembly. Anything that could be officially considered would be considered legislation.
Okay.
Measure is in there, Mr. Chairman, for purposes of making sure that it's talking about the things that you need to speak.
Not necessarily the Legislative Assembly, but Measure 1.
The second thing
represent Bengalsvik, in which House Bill 2530 goes beyond what this legislation would accomplish. And so House Bill 2530 refers also to lobbying of administrative agents, and that would not be covered by the narrower reading of lobbying here, which refers specifically to influencing legislation or measures by contributors for the legislature.
Do you have any comment on his point about measures?
Well, if measure is speaking in terms of, say, something that would be subject to initiative or referendum, then that narrows the definition of lobbying, because that means you can, that it's lobbying only with respect to something that's going to go to the people, and that strikes me as much too narrow as that.
Well,
I
might go ahead,
Dick.
Well, Mr. Chairman, we don't really hold any brief for the word measure. That's a matter of semantics there. And whatever is before the Legislative Assembly, we would intend to affect in whatever is the most understandable fashion. So we don't have any objection to a change in the word measure. We would leave that, I think, to Legislative Council in consideration of how those expressions are used in other statutes. It's generally understood meaning. We do have in our existing legislation, our existing law, provision that does take in public employees.
Okay, and then C.
All right, well, let me, I'm down to B here. B would be changed to read, this is 2 sub B, any person, including a public employee, who is a regular part of his employment, lobbies. And that, again, relates back to the definition of lobbying. The reason for that is because in the existing law, the expression attempts to influence legislation is narrower than the definition of lobbying. And then to get to this other consideration of groups, people who come down here maybe not compensated, C would be added to provide any person who provides his personal services without compensation as a representative of a corporation, association, organization, or other basic purposes of lobbying. And then to effectuate that properly, we shall say that if that organization was going to be interested in legislation lobbying, that there should be some way in which they could or should designate a representative, so you know who's who. This C really would have to relate to a provision which is found in the second page you have, which substantially is a requirement that any association who it would be referred to in this subparagraph C would be required to designate a representative or representative who would then register as a lobbyist and would probably then come under the provisions of the balance of any registration requirements that we have. So we have, our efforts have extended this far to try to make a reasonable definition of a lobbyist to include those for hire, those not for hire, who is a regular part of their efforts lobby for an organization of some sort.
Doesn't seem to cover, and you're not intending to cover, I assume, somebody who's just doing it for fun.
Well, we thought this, Mr. Chairman, that if we do that, then we just didn't figure that there's any workable way to have a registration system that would take them all in without wholesale violation or without really infringing on the right of an individual to come in and speak his piece if he wants to. So this seemed to be an area that we could involve in a registration program reasonably without getting the thing too far afield and making too difficult a problem for the registration department.
Okay, C, in your opinion, would take care of the right to life people.
Yes, and the steelhead people and the clean air people and the anybody who...
The gun club?
Yeah, right.
Okay, do you have any, on the second page, are there any questions that they call?
Yes, is the intent then of applying these definitions? These are the people who would be required to register and file financial statements?
Yes.
Well, let me ask you some questions if I'm right, Mr. Chairman. The 2A, or 2B, wouldn't this include just about every representative of state agency?
Two A or D? 2B?
Yes, but that's existing law.
Yeah, now we're going to require them to do something they don't have to do now. That's why I'm wondering why. What is the necessity or need to have an administrator in the health division that is registered to lobby? Because a regular part of his employment is over here lobbying the legislature.
Agriculture budget, we must have at least half of their hearing 42 employees down there. Testifying and trying to influence legislation. And that's what George is objecting to, isn't it, George?
Yeah. Yeah, we have it all the time. The administrator will bring three or four of his agency, depending on which section of the bill you're talking about, to provide factual information. And they might be there for one day, and the next day
they'll
take
somebody
else.
Could they be considered
a staff
people of the state somewhere?
Corrections are the same way.
Well,
the problem's not getting them there, it's getting straight answers out of them.
Right on.
Okay.
Okay,
with that.
Farther on, in any bill, of course, there are exceptions which you can draw whatever lines you want. Now, the way I read the existing law, public employee is a lobbyist under the definition. Under the exception, they accept any person who appears before a legislative committee or the governor but who is not a lobbyist, and any elected official of this state, accepting members of the legislative assembly. So it would seem that maybe under our present system they are required to register, but when we get down to talking about reporting, maybe this is a proper area for some kind of exemption. But or if we really do not hold any particular brief on how the public employees lobby, it would seem to some extent maybe they ought to be that there ought to be some way to know who's lobbying for what agency and so forth. But that would be the up to the committee. I think under existing law they have to register.
Do they?
Well, that's the way I read here. Then.
No, but do they? Are they?
I really don't know. I can't answer that.
Well, during the recent unpleasantness, when the elected heads of the state government were out for and against a particular measure, would that have been lobbying according to the definition here, and should they have registered?
Well, I think that was an invert to what was that?
No, but according to this, according to the legislative council, major refers to something referred to the people.
They were lobbying the people.
Yeah.
Any kind of government official who has or hasn't registered.
What's the intent of the bill, Dave?
Well, 2530 defines everyone broadly as lobbyists in an attempt to reach exclusion, and a public official acting in official capacity is an exclusion. And that was largely because, frankly, attempts to draft the legislation grew to heat it. There's no objection in principle to including public employees, but it's very difficult to know how to include the proper one and exclude the other. The agency employee who is brought along to the hearing that helps provide factual information from the person who's the agency head or governmental, intergovernmental relations head or whatever you call it, your own euphemism for relating. It's very difficult to draw. The one thing you might do is need, if you wanted to include that, is to leave it to further rulemaking by the administrative agency or whatever it is that implements the legislation. We excluded it not because in principle it's undesirable, but simply that seems to be pragmatic approach to making legislation workable.
I have a further question regarding the sub C. The corporation group, the corporation, is a private corporation. Representative Cole, as I understood what Mr. Allen was concerned about, I think he intended for that to be
not a public employee, but he represents a municipal corporation, then he would have to file. For instance, the lobbyist for the city has to file now, but the city officials come down here and lobbyists personally, they don't have to file it.
Is the mayor employed when he doesn't receive any
legislative standing, so
under our present law, probably a mayor, whether or not he's one like the city of Salem or one like Portland, does it not, they would not be practiced lodgers. And we haven't undertaken to do anything with these existing exemptions.
But Goldsmith's AA and Trump's administrative assistant and fellow works for the county commissioners, those guys are all lobbyists who want to register under the existing
law. I agree. They don't. My county commissioners come down here, they bring somebody from the DA's office and somebody from the road department and all these people and come down and lobby me, and none of them register, and they come down about once a week.
Well,
and they should. They want to come down here and get away from the public complaints. No, but I think they should have to register. I really do, and I don't know how to.
Why? That's sort of what he said. He couldn't figure out the right definition.
Why should they? They're lobbying just like anybody else.
I think it really comes almost down to that.
They aren't doing it.
What is regular part of your employment?
Okay. I'll tell you why. The guy from DA's office is receiving taxpayers' money that are paying his wages, and those taxpayers should have some way to know that he's down here lobbying. The same with the guy from the road department and the county commissioners. And I think that all the people in my county should know that they're down here lobbying on certain legislation, whether it's for the citizens or not. They're spending taxpayers' money to do it. That's one reason.
I don't want to argue that comment, but one of the things that you might make, it's not totally satisfactory, whether as maybe Dave or Senator Bailey were pointing out, whether it's part of their employment. Now, the staff of the Association of Oregon County, for example, they've recognized that they should register and are registered upon them. The distinction might be drawn with talking with county employees that have got maybe a regular part of their employment, but it's rather they do come down.
I think this is one of the basic questions that the committee has to wrestle with is who is a lobbyist. Yeah, Dave.
You might turn up then angle to page 5 of the memorandum I just sent to you and Andrew Ripper. Because there you will see where the New Jersey legislature wrestles with that same kind of problem. I mean, their definition of lobbyist, which they refer to as legislative agent, they make an exception beginning here with a proviso about 6 or 7 lines down. Provided, however, that a person shall not be deemed a legislative agent who, in relation to the duties or interests of his employment, or at the request or suggestion of his employer, communicates to the legislature, the governor, or the staff concerning any legislation. If such miscommunication is an isolated, exceptional, or infrequent activity in relation to the use of his employment, then it proceeds to argue this point, that the Attorney General shall develop and promulgate reasonable rules and guidelines for ascertaining whether a person's communication or communications are isolated, exceptional, or infrequent within the intent of his subsection. That's one way, in effect, of delegating the authority to the agency, the reporting agency, to help flesh out the details, much like the IRS, for example, in drawing up rules for reporting of income or allocation of income, has detailed rules with respect to percentages, divorces, this activity, and other. I think it can be done. Obviously, there's some line drawing at some point or another, but I don't think that's the deep purpose. One might adopt these books in the year with a way of defining
in other words, passing the buck to the Secretary of State.
Well, I think that the buck is fairly clearly delineated here. When you say infrequent, I think that means infrequent. And while you might differ on the degree of time or the job description, allocation of time.
We now register with the Secretary of State, do we? Where do we register?
Legislative Council.
Legislative Council? You go.
tend to think that the longer definition you have, the more you have to start explaining what you've already said. And like this New Jersey thing, and
you're the first attorney I've ever heard who expressed this opinion. And I welcome it.
That's right. thank you. We tend to think that the definition of lobbying in existing statute went through some of this previously, and we think it pretty much reflects what lobbying is.
Okay. That's one of the things I'm concerned about in the bill, the definition. Another one is what protection the lobbyists have from the legislature. And do they need protection from the legislature?
No. I can't speak for the lobbyists on that point, Mr. Chairman, because we have not taken that up. I'm not here with authority to express my opinion on that.
Another thing, Dave, that I'm sure the committee is not going to like is including identification by number of the bills or resolutions.
I think that it's possible to resolve this in a way that might be acceptable if I can outline just in theory at least what that resolution would be. But I understand that one of the problems that the committee and the members of the Capitol Public had is that this would be burdensome without being revealing, that they wouldn't know necessarily ahead of time precisely what bills they'd be lobbying on, and therefore they'd be making a mistake at their peril of running into a criminal action. I agree that that's a realistic and sensible objection. One way that it might be resolved would be this. That in the registration statement, when the lobbyist registers in Airport, that you have the lobbyist required to give a generic area, subject matter area, in which he's interested. And then in the reporting, surely should be known to the lobbyist all those bills on which he's reported, or on which he's lobbied, during the past session for which he's been in the report now. So he wouldn't be forcing the person to guess. With respect to statement of position, pro or con legislation, this is something that Tom and Todd discussed at great length last Saturday, and we have reached the conclusion that if it would help in any way to reach a process of reasonable accommodation, that we would be prepared to say that
statement of position is very difficult because they may be in favor of all the bill but one section.
Yes, I agree. The comma can change the meaning. It's because of that, that I think that insofar as the legislation as drafted would now require that, we would have no objection to the submission.
Dick, do you or Ward have any comment on?
Yes, we would. We object to inclusion of a requirement directed to bills, their content, what we're for against. By and large, most lobbyists, when they register their position, their who they represent, obviously. If that, in situations where there has to be a category of interest designated because of the lack of some definition in the name of their employer, this is okay. But it just doesn't seem to me that there is any reasonable benefit to be derived from having somebody burdened with trying to designate a position from time to time on bills. But I don't think that it's warranted.
I noticed that the last thing that Mr. Frommeyer mentioned was the possibility of reporting which ones you had not been doing, and not necessarily listing the numbers. That kind of something that I have seen some language sometimes that says the general area of interest of the person. Now let me put a question to you. There's no press left in this. Well, I was going to be personal. Personally, you come down here and you say Safeway stores. Now how the hell would you know which position to find and why this position? Would you know where to find out? And then you'll probably spend half the remaining days there. Tell us a way to approach that, which will figure out.
talking about the purpose of lobbying legislation to disclose the influences that are brought to bear on the process, and they're speaking not just for the legislator himself, but for the public. There's no way that one can measure the financial impact. For example, $20,000 comes into the process in the last month. You don't have some mechanism by which you determine the bill or the bill number that it's directed to. You're still essentially at a loss as to what that money is, what that influence is doing. It seems to me that's a matter of public information.
No.
Well, Herb Lobby's done a lot of things too, and very effectively, that he's not getting paid for by anybody. But simply because he's a very bright man, he's a very concerned citizen. And I used him on a lot of things, which he probably wouldn't want anybody to know either. But not because he's getting paid by anybody, because I know he has expertise in that particular area. Or, what do you do about the problem? I'm sitting next to a lobbyist today, and they just found out about a bill. Somehow they didn't even know that it was in.
When they file their next report, and if they lobbied on it, they simply list it in. There's no penalty for that. That's no hardship. The concern that we were addressing is the hardship of forcing a person to second guess whether or not at the end of the session they might have been interested in 2 dozen or 100 bills. But surely they know if they have a bill from the Constitution and they attempt to influence their vote or whatever, they surely know that. There's no hardship to report. And the question is whether or not it's an unfair to ask them to report it, which somehow destroys the confidentiality of the process. It seems to me that's not a proper subject of confidentiality. Especially the pro bono lobbying. If you restrict lobbying and compensate lobbying, that would be reported anyway.
What are you accomplishing by an after the fact listing of bills?
Well, I suppose at least with respect to everything from voting records and accountability to potential referral measures to decisions. For example, after it's passed the legislature, there's still the question of whether or not the governor can veto it. And therefore, it's appropriate for persons to know if they wish to contact the governor on a bill. Whether or not, and the extent to which influences, which they regarded as improper, might have been brought to bear on. So there's still a time lag which gives reaction time under those circumstances, and I think it's a problem.
May I ask, if you think that Dick Allen, as a lobbyist, receives the sum of money to lobby on a particular bill, and you say voting record, and I voted either for or against, but I voted according to whatever his interest happened to be, how can you attach the voting record to the lobbyist?
Your voting record to the lobbyist?
Well, anybody's voting record. I think that can't be done except
sort of in the aggregate. I think that if there is evidence that a large amount of effort is brought to bear on legislation, that may say something about the extent to which side was heard more simply because of numbers. But I wouldn't go beyond that and say that it has any evidentiary significance whatsoever.
That really scares me.
I'm sorry, Debbie, I'm not sure what you're saying.
You know, that you're trying to connect the voting records of the people in this assembly with the amount of money spent. Now, for instance, there are a lot...
Well, on an individual basis, unless you record each contact that a lot of us have, it's simply not significant, couldn't be significant, as evidence, as a political pamphlet or anything. But I think it's fair to say that if the legislature has been seemingly more responsive in one direction than another, that may have something to do with the amount of lobbying that was distributed in that direction. How significant that is to an individual voter, I don't know.
Well, I happen to be kind of opposed to anarchy, and nobody's lobbied me on it, but I voted against every bill on anarchy.
But what? I'm not sure.
But if one comes up, I'll vote against it. Ward, you have any comments?
I don't know. There's a couple of votes you made that I have questions.
The question I think is bothering me is, and I'm trying to be receptive to what David's saying and the ill they're trying to get at. But I'm a little taken with the course of questioning that person in politics. I mean, a little bit away from seeing the relevance of having the lobbyists disclose what it is he's working on. And I've seen so many instances where I think it would be very unfair to repute on the lobbyists the result of the legislative vote, good or bad. I've seen some discredit to things that should not be there. I just kind of question, I think maybe I can see the need for money disclosures. I could come very close, I think, to accepting quite a bit in the area of, how money is.
lobbyist had or expenditure or something, so that they say, here is how this occurred, and that may not have anything to do with it. And I think that if we saddle the lobbyists collectively with hundreds of man hours to perform a function, saddle a state agency with thousands of man hours to perform a function, and all the dollars that represents, you have to kind of consider what the benefit is. You know, whether whose curiosity is to be satisfied, and whether this is going to improve the legislative process.
Can I ask David a question? David, were you around here last session?
Oh, only on by hearing.
What measures, granted we passed so few that are worthy of any attention at all, but what measures that we have dealt with or are dealing with now that you're curious about as far as the source of lobbying is concerned that you do not have access to?
Well, I think this is the most dramatic is the governor's tax plan. Of course, one finds out about that from the CME reports rather than from lobbying, but certainly in principle that's no different from the kind of information that we seek here. And that's a perfect example. The campaign expenditure bill forced persons to disclose very specifically the object of their expenditures for the precise purpose that some voters may think it's relevant that one economic group supports legislation as opposed to the other. Now, that's not just the inference that you can draw.
Let's talk about the government tax plan. If I may, I'm very curious about this because now, what expenditures? Do you mean as far as the passage of it?
Passage or defeat, depends on
the area. Now, wait a minute. You know, now, this is what really concerns me. One of the reasons I've always gone and made speeches about one of the problems with the legislative process is that the legislators pass bills like the tax plan, the 69 tax plan, and then they wash their hands and go home in their little old burrows and stay there, and they don't go out and inform the public. Now, whenever I spoke on the tax plan, I never felt that I had to, account, that I wasn't lobbying. I was informing my constituency and explaining why I voted for it or didn't favor it.
I think that's proper. That's the function.
Well, then how do you separate my efforts from the governor's
your efforts and the government's efforts and the efforts of anyone who as a legislative official voted for that and then sought to make public opinion. I have no quarrel with that as being precisely the time when you're elected. None whatsoever. So let me make two points on it. First of all, is that reporting by bill number and identifying this in details, including statement of position, is not something we dreamed up. That's already law in several states, and I applaud your commitment to us with that. So that's being done. It is workable. It can work. We didn't choose to go that far, and we're telling you tonight that in the interest of reaching accommodation that we get this bill through, we'll back off that. But it bothers my mind, frankly, to say that, well, it's important to disclose that you're a lobbyist, but you shouldn't have to disclose what you're lobbying for. And that's almost as though you're saying, well, you're not, because you may not be effective, that it's not, you may not achieve your objective, but therefore it's improper to infer to you.
If the lobbyist simply lists as generic, why would that not suffice?
Well, for one thing, don't let me cut off the words here, but for one thing, it may be that secret opposition or relatively secret opposition for a bill is developing. It may be terribly important for other interests which might be affected by that bill to know that a massive effort is being mounted to defeat it, for one thing, or to pass it. It's a way of keeping a hidden process or making a hidden process more open. It's one way of giving notice.
Now, can you give us an example for that?
Well,
if you're in the system and you have other ways of knowing, or you already know these things.
That's the point, is that you are in it. Even in Eugene, Oregon, with a good telephone and a lot of interest in state politics, it's very hard to be informed. And a person sitting down there in Medford, Oregon, or over in Klamath Falls, may not know anything unless a newspaper publishes that a massive concerted effort is being made to defeat SB 3000. And until you know that, unless there's some form of disclosing that, you may be in no position to mobilize your own interests and get them into the political process. That's why I think you have to open that number. But
would you say a massive effort is being made to pass House Bill 2529?
You mean the conflict of interest bill?
No, that's the one we're talking about.
We're talking about 2530,
which, all right, either one of them.
Well, we've made no attempt to hide the fact that there are 3,000 common cause members in Oregon, and then at least every one of them, to our knowledge, has been informed of all four of the bills, and it sounds like they've been urged to write legislation and so forth. I don't think that's massive. It generated very little visibility, but I think it's appropriate that if that is the first time that a person who might be a lobbyist or outside the state with occasional contact here would realize that his interests were affected, I think it's wholly appropriate that we disclose our interest there so we can come and protect it in the process.
I have Dave a question. Dave, I never heard of a massive hidden process. Those two terms contradict each other.
It's hidden only for a short period of time, but by the time it's disclosed, it may well be too late to affect it. The bottle bill, of course, has always counted out in chamber four, and I'm not really qualified to speak on it, but I think that's the case where large amounts of money came into this process in a very short period of time. I think it backfired, and that's a circumstance, because of several unfortunate incidents that backfired. But that's the kind of thing where in the middle of the session. Oh, I think it was fortunate for the integrity of the process, and I think it's fortunate because it demonstrated that the legislature itself reacted adversely to improper tactics by legislative action.
But Dave, on the Shield bill, for instance, we had a group of newspaper people and broadcasters appear and do their thing, and we probably won't see them again all session. And I don't think they spent any money, but I know them.
There's a specific meaning with respect to what their obligations might be?
Well, what do you do about them?
There's a specific exemption for newspapermen and news media people with respect to editorializing, unless...
But they were here lobbying for the Shield bill.
Yeah, under those circumstances, they should register.
All right, they have one paid lobbyist registered.
That's right.
But they brought in other people to speak to that bill.
That's lobbying for a particular interest of an important segment of society. Apart from the more general kind of lobbying for a con that occurs in the editorial page every day, and to the extent that it is protecting the economic and political and legal rights of that organization, it's appropriate that it should register for that purpose. For that purpose.
Warren?
Can I ask a question? Not from the standpoint of being argumentative today, but I think it's helping our understanding now. The problem, the ill we're trying to resolve, Dave, you made the comment that, again, to pick an illustration, because it does help to relay what we're trying to talk about, youthful volatility, and maybe that's the wrong term, that there was a massive amount of money brought in, and used the term in an improper way. Now, I think maybe it's relevant to ask, in what way was that improper?
Well, I don't think it's improper. I think that it's my understanding, in fact, speeches were made on the Senate floor with respect to an improper approach that was made to a given legislature, which I'm also led to understand was influential in causing persons to cast votes otherwise than they might have been. I don't think that the infusion of money is improper. I don't have any objection to that. It may be that
there's nothing hidden about the money or the influence from both sides.
Well, I should say it was hidden from the public. It may have been known to legislators who saw it being spent, but there are contentions that the need to know goes well beyond the persons in Salem who probably know from sources of their own income.
But I don't see how, if it was hidden from the public, it was only because the press chose not to write that. It was there available for anybody that wanted to sit and observe the proceedings for more than 6 hours.
Well, but there are precious few people who either can or have the time or money to do that. Whereas if the information is collected in central place, it first of all becomes much more reportable news.
Well, what could have been reported under the old lobbying law during last session that would have divulged more during the bottle bill fight?
I suppose lots more. First of all, who was lobbying for what with respect to that bill? Second, how much money they were spending? Again, I point out, maybe by the time that monthly report came in, it would have been too late. And legislators. A legislator might or might not be horrified to know that what seems to be a grassroots campaign is really a very slick enterprise that's highly financed from sources outside the state for purposes not related to the good orientation. Whereas the legislator might not have known that, absent the report. Certainly the government extent.
I must have missed something on that bill. I didn't say it might.
Well, you'd be interested in knowing who's going to look at the report that are filed in May about something we did in February and make a evaluation or a determination of what influences were involved in the manner in which the legislature voted. Are you going to make that? Come down and read the record, and you're going to interpret that for the public?
are you anticipating report facts?
Facts are reported when campaign expenditures are disclosed, and some members of the public think they're highly significant, others think they're completely ordinary. And it seems to me that is, in that sense, public information. But I see the relevance of the information is no more or no less important than campaign contribution expenditure information. I don't know why this is one way of affecting public decisions in lobbying, and it's probably more effective than affecting them by campaign expenditure. No reason why we should have complete openness with respect to the first, and then be so reluctant to move that same direction to the second.
Well, the reason is because the legislator and to some extent the lobbyist is possibly suggested that printing out money is spent in preliminary discussions will disclose it.
Real
kind of fond of the First Amendment, Dave. That's not the level of First Amendment.
In our present system, we don't, you know, that are not fair. And I think we have to be very careful that we don't draft bills that will make it work.
I don't remember the name of the case, but there is a case where basically told you can't abridge the effort to stir up a grassroots campaign.